Hello and welcome to The Detail. I'm Katie Melua.
And I'm Polly Scattergood.
This week we have a very special guest, the incredible singer-songwriter and producer Shura. Shura's debut record, Nothing's Real, came out in 2016, followed by Forever in 2019. And then this year, the wonderful deluxe edition of that album came out that included some really beautiful and intimate demo versions of the original tracks. Not only is Shura an acclaimed artist and writer, she has also found ingenious ways of using her art and videos to challenge stereotypes and, to quote The Guardian, blurring gender and sexuality, offering an alternative to the conventional pop star aesthetic, which is something that we will always support and champion on this podcast.
If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me, Polly Scattergood, in my studio at home. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to show your support. The address is patreon.com/Polly Scattergood. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. Shura, welcome. We've been listening to your albums and they just have this wonderful nostalgic feel to them, but with a really sort of modern twist. I love the sound bites that you use in your production across both albums. They really kind of help set a scene for the songs. I was wondering, how do you begin when you're writing a song? Can you describe your ideal surroundings and where do you start writing?
Firstly, hello, and I was kind of like listening to that intro and I was just like, oh my god, you know, when you just never really think about what you do or what you've done, and sometimes it's just kind of nice to hear someone list it out. I was like, oh, I'm quite moved. So thank you for that lovely intro. In terms of where I like to begin, I think for me it's always really alone. I think that's in part because it's just how I started writing songs. I didn't really want anyone to know I was doing it. So I picked up a guitar when I was about 13 years old because my dad had several kind of lying around the house. And I kind of asked him at 13, I said, can you teach me? And he taught me the chords E, A and B seventh. So that I could play the blues. And I was like, I don't really want to play the blues. So after those three chords, I think I just was like, okay, I'm just going to teach myself. And I just started playing kind of other people's songs, or, you know, songs that I liked from films. And I think the first one was from a film called Josie and the Pussycat. So I can't even say it's like a really cool song that I wanted to play. I just started writing kind of in my bedroom at the top of the house. It was kind of like an attic room, and kind of very quietly recording myself. So really, I guess I always like to start like that. Or I think the best songs that I write normally start with just me and a crappy guitar noodling.
Do you produce all your own stuff or do you work with other producers?
I definitely would not be confident producing everything myself. So I've worked with producers for everything I've done. I just think because I'm self-taught, I think I have a lot of I still have a lot of that kind of imposter syndrome stuff. I couldn't possibly, but of course I'm convinced that I am an actual imposter, that I absolutely could not do it alone. But I also really enjoy working with other people. I love writing with other people. So even though, you know, an idea may start with me on a tiny guitar, I like to open up that process fairly quickly. I don't know whether that's because I'm a twin and so I just like having another person with me at all times, sort of tethered in that way.
Yeah. Records are they are complicated, beautiful, sophisticated things, you know. And I think this idea that it just takes one person is kind of you know, it's almost, dare I use the word, simplistic, you know? So I think, you know, our records and our music does come from the collaborations we make, you know, and also how we were raised and what we went through as kids. So I actually, Shura, wanted to ask you about you know, your childhood. And, you know, you mentioned picking up the guitar, the guitars that were lying around at your dad's place. You know, how did living with him influence you and you know, and your parents? And I also know that your mum is Russian. So I'd be curious to know, you know, if you've kind of thought about how, you know, that upbringing affected the music and the artist that you are now.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think how to begin answering that, because it's, of course, quite difficult to know in some senses how your upbringing affects how you are. And I think if we knew all the answers to those questions, of course, we would be free of so many problems too. But I mean, in a very literal sense, you know, or an obvious sense, maybe that's the right word to use. You know, my dad was musical. My mum was musical. They're both creative people. My dad played the guitar. He played the piano. He's not a virtuoso in either, but it was, music was always a part of our house and our upbringing. And I think, you know, my parents separated when I was very young, when I was 3 years old. And one of the things that we lived with our dad, and one of the things that he did, I guess, to sort of, you know, as part of our routine, was instead of story time at bedtime, we would do kind of singing time with me and my twin, and he would play guitar and he would play the songs that he'd written for us as kids, which would be kind of very silly, kind of nursery rhyme kind of songs. You know, I remember there was a song called Billy the Bullfrog, which was about a frog that jumped so high he ended up getting decapitated by an airplane. So we would do these. So yeah, I always had music around me. My twin brother had, you know, loved singing as a kid, and in fact has a beautiful voice, trained in musical theatre, technically a much better singing voice than me. And in fact I even remember my dad often he would say, Nick, you've got a beautiful voice, and Shu, you've figured out a way to sing that works for you. You know, that was the so it's funny that I ended up, I guess, making a career of music. But yeah, it was, I think I was just given, you know, there was an environment that meant that picking up a guitar and writing songs wasn't perceived as strange, or, you know, that I wasn't being kind of, I don't know, ridiculous for doing it. And I remember very early songs that I wrote, my dad would sort of maybe overhear, because he also had he had like a four track recorder to record himself, and I borrowed it, so I would borrow it and take it upstairs, and he would hear things that I had done, and I'm not sure that I even played them to him, so I was probably quite cross when I realized he'd listened. And he said, I have this really strong memory of him saying, Shu, you're quite good at this, have you ever thought about doing it for a career? And I can't have been more than 14, 15. And I got so angry with him. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, and we both kind of look back on that moment and sort of laugh, because I think the reason I was upset was that it was probably true. It was something that I had thought about and wanted to do, but that I had thought that maybe I was embarrassed of that, that I was maybe embarrassed that he'd found me out, you know, and that there's something scary about saying you want to do something, because then if you don't end up doing it, you know, maybe you failed. And yeah, that was a really strong memory from kind of my teendom.
It's so interesting hearing you talk about that. And also I just picked up on the bit where you were saying about you had the four track recorder that was your dad's, and it kind of leads me very nicely onto something that spoke to me when I was listening to your record. There's a track called Tommy. I'm just gonna, for the listener, in case any of the listeners don't know the specific track I'm talking about, it's this beautiful recording of a man who's kind of telling a story about his life, and it sounds like he's maybe in a cafe or like a roadside pit stop or something. And obviously, our podcast is called The Detail, so we'd love to know, when you recorded the soundbite for Tommy, how did that happen? Did you happen to have a dictaphone with you in a cafe, or how did that come about?
I normally carry kind of like a Zoom recorder with me when I travel, because I like to record kind of it could be anything, whether it's trains or the sound of trains on train tracks, or airplanes and birds. And I just like to have a lot of those kind of found sounds with me, because I find I often want to put them in as textures, and I just like having my own versions of them rather than ones I have to kind of download from Freesound. Yeah. But on this occasion, I it wasn't actually me who recorded this. It was my girlfriend, and we were in Marfa, Texas. We entered a Dairy Queen, and this elder gentleman kind of welcomed us as if he owned the place, and he didn't. He was just there with his friend, and he began talking to us, and I don't know, I mean, it must have just been that his kind of personality and the way he spoke was just so sort of extraordinary. Yeah. It just compelled my girlfriend to record, and it was just on an iPhone, and I don't think either of us even at the time ever conceived of it being a part of something that I would make into a song. It was just that we almost couldn't believe what we were hearing. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to make a record of it so that we could just remember exactly what he was saying. And so that we could listen to it and go, did that really just happen? It was like a scene from a movie.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't until I'd written the song about him that it occurred to me to try and find that recording, and then try and get in touch with him. Yeah, I mean, getting in touch with him to ask him if we could even use it was also just I feel like I could make a documentary about that in and of itself. Well, yeah. Marfa, thankfully, is it's a very small town, of course, and he had introduced himself by name and not surname, but we managed to sort of, I think I just Googled the first name and Marfa, and he happened to be kind of on the city council, you know, and I kind of found the picture, and then I contacted, what did I do? I found him on Facebook, and I tried to add him on Facebook, and obviously he didn't accept my request because I don't think he even saw it.
Yeah.
And so I then found a family member, and I messaged them saying, hello, I'm trying to get in touch with so-and-so. I've sent him a friend request and a message, but I don't know if he's seen it. And they replied and said, oh, I don't know, but here's his number. So I called him and I said, I've sent you a message. And he was like, I don't know where to find, I've got an email, but I don't know where to find it, you know, kind of thing. And I was like, oh my God. Okay. So I basically sort of explained to him, you know, what had happened and if I'd like him to listen to the song and approve, you know, the use of it, of course. And so the way that we ended up doing it is, instead of emailing it to him because he wasn't sure how to find his inbox, I had to email Marfa City Radio. And I said, hi, this is probably one of the most unusual requests you'll receive, but I'm sending you a song and please don't play it on the radio. But this gentleman is going to come in and have a listen. And let me know if he's okay. And so we did it that way, and he listened, and he said he loved it, and he also said he wanted me to send him the lyrics because he couldn't really understand what I was saying. So we did that, and it was all approved in the end. But yeah, it was a bizarre experience.
It's just remarkable, and I just love the fact that, you know, this man talking on a single night on a completely unrepeatable event. You know, and it sparks something, mm-hmm. and it, you know, mm-hmm. and it's also about a way of looking at life, where you're sort of open to inspiration from all directions. Shura, I also wanted to ask you, you worked with Mel C from the Spice Girls on the track called Good Enough. So you wrote with her, which is just remarkable. Could you describe how that session worked?
Firstly, I received an email from my manager saying that Mel C was quite liked my music and was interested in me writing with her, which I couldn't really believe. I didn't really believe, and kind of asked if I was interested in working with her. To which I replied, absolutely yes. When, where, like, how do I make this happen? And it it was, I think it's one of the only times I've ever asked anyone for a photograph, actually, because it was just such Mel C, like,
I mean, she's a legend.
Yeah, and Sporty Spice for me was such an important figure in my childhood because I was a tomboy. I played football for Manchester City. You know, they were a girl group, and I was the exact right age, you know, to be in love with the Spice Girls. And here was a Spice Girl that was me, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I really just adored her, I just went, and you know, there she was, just very unassuming, sat on a sofa, and we, you know, I think I made her a cup of tea, and we just began talking and writing, and it was, you know, she was very lovely, incredibly funny, absolutely wanted to kind of you know, write about something that meant something, which made me incredibly excited because I, you know, I've been in sessions before where, you know, what a song is about doesn't really matter, which is valid, absolutely valid, but it's just not, I think it's not, it doesn't play to any of my strengths as a writer. I'm unfortunately kind of incredibly autobiographical, which makes writing when I'm not doing anything very difficult. So the past year's been a challenge.
In a way, part of, you know, the questioning that we like to do is to kind of find out what our guests, what their sort of paths and rules are, you know. So that's really interesting. So she really wanted to make sure it had meaning. And then what sparked the song, and kind of was it a quick write, or was it a long and laborious one? Because, you know, we know that they can exist.
They absolutely can. It was just the one day, because it was I think the week of the I wrote it kind of a week or two before Forever was about to be released. And I think, you know, we all know that the you know, releasing a record whilst it's wonderful is also one of the most stressful times for an artist. But I just did the one day. And in fact, I had written with Mel a very different chorus that didn't ended up just not being there. And I think it was a hook that was from the pre that was then reworked. And I wasn't a part of that process, which I don't mind. I'm actually, when I'm, weirdly, when I'm writing for myself, I'm incredibly precious about. Well, that's not true, actually. I'm very open to collaboration, but when I know when I think I know, then that's it, sort of thing. Whereas with other people, I just go, well, I want you to be happy. It's your song, and it's how you're singing it. So, I mean, it was you know, it was about a friendship that was tricky, and you know, I don't want to go into too much detail, obviously, because I think, you know, there's some things that are said in a room that you know, you have to keep secret.
Of course.
Yeah. But you know, it was about that. And what was interesting to me was how it in fact changed from the session to, you know, I heard it very, very late, you know, the final version very late on, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, you know, I wouldn't have done that there. But that's sort of the that's sort of the exciting part, I think, about writing for other artists, is that, you know, you might do a whole day and nothing you've done ends up there, but it doesn't mean that it hasn't been part of the process. I think that's the exciting bit for me, is that, you know, it's about what your, you know, what someone's idea inspires you to come up with, and vice versa. And I think that's why I love collaboration, because you just get somewhere that, you know, I get somewhere I never would have got on the Todd.
It's almost like two different, completely different ways of working, isn't it? Like you say, when you're working with somebody else and you almost hand them the final decisions, and then when it's your own song, you know, you just have that feeling, that instinct that, you know what you want. Talking of which, there's a song on your first album called Nothing's Real. It's got these beautiful upbeat sort of synth lines, which are just so warm and wonderful. But lyrically, I was kind of drawn into it, and I read a little bit about it, and I read that you were recounting an experience where you thought that you were dying, and it turned out to be a panic attack. Mental health is something that we've talked quite a lot about on this podcast with various artists. And so I hope that you don't find this question too personal, but was it a very hard song to write, or did it come out quite fast as a kind of cathartic experience? Can you talk to us a little bit about that track?
Of course. I'm very passionate about talking about mental health, and my first record was named after a song about my first ever panic attack. I actually have very limited memory of how long it took. Weirdly, it's strange to me that I don't know how long it took to write. I don't recall it being difficult. What was interesting was obviously once I'd written that song, that became... So I don't know if... Okay, I don't know how you guys are with when you're writing a record, but I have a couple of moments always during them. One is sort of writing the song that feels like stylistically it's sort of the heart of the record, and from which all other... For me, it's very important that all the songs can connect back to this song, and it doesn't have to be directly. It doesn't have to be, okay, Nothing's Real connects to Touch. It could be Nothing's Real connects to Touch via Indecision, via Too Shy, and then back to Touch. You know, it's like I need to be able to draw that line. And for me, the heart of the record was Touch. It was the first song that I wrote that kind of accidentally went viral, and I was just like, whoops. would have maybe planned this differently had I known this would happen. And thematically, I think Nothing's Real was this. It was, you know, once I'd written that, I just knew that was the title. I just knew that, and then I had ideas about what the artwork would be, and that was kind of the song that once I'd written that, I just knew what the record was going to be called. And the experience itself was just, it was extraordinary, and I think completely related to everything that had happened up until that moment with regards to my career. It felt like very much a record of that period of my life, in that, you know, I did make a song and I made a video myself and it did go viral, and all of a sudden I had an incredible amount of attention on something that I'd been doing since I was 16, and suddenly I was kind of, you know, a signed artist, and people were going, when's a record coming out? And I would just be thinking, well, I've only written two other songs that are like this. And I felt like I'd been sort of flung onto a treadmill, but kind of at running speed. and that I
That's
had to,
hard.
Yeah, and I just had to sort of... And I think that's why I sort of had this... I also blame my cats, weirdly. So I just, I'd signed a record deal and I was like, I'm going to get cats. Because I'd always wanted to have, I'd had a cat as a kid, and I was like, I'm going to get a cat. And my twin was like, I'll go look for cats. And he found these two cats. One was a girl and one was a boy. And I really wanted a tabby that was a boy for some reason. And I wanted to call him Flump. And unfortunately, the cats that were there were a female tabby and a black cat who was male. And I was like, oh, God, this is, what do I do here? And my twin was like, what about both? And then I was like, but I've only got one name. So I went from naught to two cats in a very quick period. And I think having them and being responsible for them kind of at this moment in my life where I was, very stressed. I was just like, oh God, like, I thought I was having, I thought I was having a heart attack. I've never had a panic attack before. I'd heard people say panic attack, and I would just think a panic attack was when someone was stressing out about something a bit more than they should. I hadn't realized that they had these, physical implications, you could have a physical symptom, for instance, before a mental one, in a sense, if that, the order of them. So I was just convinced I was dying. And in fact, I didn't even know that it was a panic attack when I left the hospital, because I'd gone in with a kind of a resting heart rate of 150 or 180 or something absurd. And once it had calmed down and they did a lung scan to check, because I was a smoker back then, and that's a terrifying thing, waiting. I just remember sort of waiting for the results of a lung scan and looking up at you know, being in a paper dress and looking up at this cheap clock, like white clock, and just thinking, oh my God, I'm terrified that I'm dying, I've got cancer or who knows what. And I remember the doctor coming back to me and saying, your lungs are fine.
Wow.
And I cried, I just cried. And kind of was kind of discharged at about 5 a.m. and I didn't have a phone, I didn't have a wallet with me, I just left my apartment with nothing, and I had to use the hospital phone and call my dad and just be like, you know, I couldn't get an Uber, I had nothing to leave with, and I just said, everything's fine, I am at the hospital, I'm fine, can you come and pick me up? And sort of, yeah, that's what that song was about, really, about that kind of that feeling of you know, being outside of your body is and watching yourself from above, almost like a bird's eye view.
Gosh, it's so incredible, Shura, to hear you talk about it. How old were you when this happened, if you don't mind me asking?
I would have been 24, 25.
Yeah, because
mid-20s.
I asked because I suffered from a brief psychotic breakdown when I was 26. And I'd also never experienced panic attacks until after I'd recovered from the breakdown. And they really are, they're so shocking, because it's exactly as you describe. It's completely, you just don't know what it is and you think you're dying. But then you do, I mean, I don't know, it sounds like, you know, you're now better and, you know, and also in my case, I was able to learn to cope with them and to deal with them and to have ways of kind of sort of recovering from them fairly quickly. And I wanted to ask you, so, you know, what were your methods of getting over them? And also any advice for young musicians on how they can, you know, get over mental health challenges and keep creative?
Yeah. I was really fortunate that I had a fantastic manager. And I think when that happened, the first thing that he said is, let me try and find some recommendations for therapy. And I got through my manager, you know, a therapist, which I, you know, I had to pay for on myself, which obviously for everyone is not an option, but for me at that moment in time was the best thing that I think one of the best decisions that I've ever made in my life. And what was kind of extraordinary to me about that was there were so many things, but basically I think everyone should have therapy, and that it's a real shame that therapy is not affordable, or that it isn't something, you know, it's something that's very difficult to do on the NHS. For instance, I tried to go through the NHS and they said, we can get you 10 sessions and you have to be there every Wednesday at this time. And I was like, well, that just doesn't work for me, because I may be in America, I may be here. And then if you miss more than two, they just cancel them. So that's why I had to sort of go privately. And what was extraordinary to me about that is that things that I had thought that I were of no, you know, no consequence to me in my life. You know, the fact that my parents had separated when I was three, I was fine with it. I was, in fact, you know, I'm thrilled that they separated, because I think life would have been much more awful had they not. And yet, you know, I found myself talking to my therapist about it and weeping, absolutely weeping over the divorce of my parents, which is something that I was, you know, fine with, but just the process of, in fact, I think for the first 2 years, I didn't have a therapy session where I didn't cry. And crying was just amazing. It sounds strange to say, but it was such a release to be able to talk to someone. And I think, so in a sense, I do think, you know, talking is one of the best things that you can do, is talking to people. And obviously that's really difficult with sometimes it's very difficult to tell people that you know really well the things. And so I you know, I do think that therapy is something that we should all do. I personally think that if you're, you know, an artist that signs to a record label, that a record label should pay for therapy for every single artist that they sign.
I completely agree.
I think that should just be a you know, in the way that if a major label signs you, they pay for your legal fees, mm-hmm. they should be paying for your therapy, yeah. a therapist as yeah. well. Obviously, that doesn't help necessarily young musicians who, you know, may at some point wish to be signed. But I think, you know, talking and, all, you know, all those things that we know, like exercise mm. and, you know, that was something that completely went out of the window. I mean, it's gone out the window now in the pandemic too, but, you know, eating well, mm. regular exercise, talking, and, you know, I wish there was sort of more mentorship that was happening in the music industry, because I think that particularly, you know, I'm sure you both as, you know, solo artists know, you kind of make an island of yourself,
yeah,
I think,
definitely.
As an
yeah.
artist. Mm-hmm. You're very much kind of isolated, you know, you, if you're not in a band, and often, you know, you're made to kind of see other solo artists as, even if it's not something that you think, but, you know, you're compared to them, whether it's by yeah. the press, by your, you know, your team. My first record label, it would be like, well, so-and-so's got B-list at radio, so we should be going mm-hmm. for A-list, or, you know, whatever. And I'm like, but so-and-so is a different mm-hmm. person. And why, you know, why are you putting this into my head? And, you know, and then, you know, you kind of have all these almost nemeses.
Yeah. Like yeah, it's like this if you sort met, of you would... unspoken competitiveness, which so mm-hmm. doesn't have to be there at all. Because I think actually if artists did get together, talk, you know, exchange, it would be a real community, you know.
Yeah, and I think that is getting better. I definitely think that is mm. happening more and more, but I think it's really important to be transparent with your open and transparent with your peers. And, you know, it's that old thing of, you know, someone else's success doesn't take anything away from you, and it, because it really doesn't. It's got nothing to do with mm-hmm. you, and the best thing that you can do is to just focus on yourself and do the things that make you proud mm. to, you know. It was like when you read that, you know, when you introduced me, and, you know, taking a second to think about what you'd said about what I'd done, I'm like, oh wow, if I'd heard, you know, if 16-year-old me had known that would be a paragraph that was said about me by Katie Mellower, you know, like, I think I would have been quite proud of myself.
No, it's
and
just,
I am.
It's such an honor to talk to you. And you know what? That whole thing about how there is this net, that this invisible net of how we perceive each other and other artists, really does need to be broken down. And like, I've really experienced it when I realized I was signed to an indie that was very reliant on our records being released quite frequently, and more frequently than I was ready to be releasing. And I just remember thinking, man, I wish there was another artist who I could kind of do seasons with, you know. So like, I know that they would release a record, like, you know, for 1 year or 2 years, and they would promote it, and then I would step in, you know. And it was like, but that's just very difficult to actually pull off, because we are humans and we're creatures. But, you know, just more of a kind of sinking in with each other, as in S-Y-N-C, not S-I-N-K, I think could be really good. So it's just delightful to hear you speak in such a way, Shura. So thank you.
Shura, you've just spoken about the pressures in your early 20s and how they affected you so deeply. I mean, I also felt this pressure, and it's something that I'm still kind of learning about, and what to tune out and what to listen to. And one thing that I wanted to ask you about was the machine that's around you now, because you described leaving Polydor as finishing a slightly shit relationship. I was interested, what's your setup now, and how have you built your ship to work for you? And has it helped your creativity being free of some of those major label pressures?
It's funny, because I think that I feel as if my second relationship was also quite shit, which has sort of given me a fresh perspective, you know, on how it was with Polydor. And you know, of course there were pressures that were, you know, difficult, but there was something, I think the thing about Polydor that was interesting is that I came into that relationship with a lot of power, not understanding that at all, but because of this song that had sort of its own accord gone viral. You know, I had 30 million, you know, views on my music video before I'd, you know, really put pen to paper. And so I was, in terms of the creative process, I mean, this is true of both records. I was left alone, more or less, to write. It wasn't until the very end, I remember, that with my major label, that they sort of said, well, we need another single.
Oh God.
To which, you know, which I was like, okay, well, that's a bit tricky, because it's you don't really go in thinking this is a single. No. For me, it's always like afterwards.
You know, and if you do, it will never be a single, right?
Yeah. Well, I also think if you try hard, I think trying hard never really works. I think that, and I don't mean working hard does work, but trying hard is different to working hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that people, you know, of course, that, you know, we know there's lots of popular music that's perhaps not particularly interesting and is popular because it's catchy or whatever, and that's valid, and I love some of it, but I think that listeners are quite they are also smart, and I think you know, people can tell if something's genuine or not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the very end was a bit tricky with trying to write that, and I was, you know, put in, you know, I'd written the whole record with Joel Pott and produced it with him, and you know, we have an incredible collaboration, and you know, it felt quite alien to me to be told, well, okay, we need something else, so let's send you off to write with someone new who, you know, in LA, and and that was a bit odd, but I think on the whole, you know, I made the record that I wanted to make. I think the thing that I most regret is the snare sound in What's It Gonna Be, that I tried to replace, but I was told by Polydor that it wasn't as good with that, so I kind of at that point relented and said, okay, keep your snare. I remember once them asking me to remix a song of mine but not tell anyone it was a remix, you know, for radio, and I remember saying that I didn't think that was a very good idea, partly because I was probably nervous that it would have done incredibly well and they would have asked me to then remix everything in that way, and, and it wasn't the style that I wanted. It was kind of, you know, they wanted to do a kind of house remix because it was the thing at the time, and I sort of said no.
I mean, I sometimes wish that some of these you know, bits of advice from record companies would actually work. You know, because like if they did, then it's like, sure, yeah, I'll do a remix, no problem, I'll change it. But like, they, you know, they don't actually know, you know, and that's, I think that's the frustrating,
and I think that's why I said no, because it's like I think I was lucky that I was a bit older when I signed, you know, so I wasn't kind of 16 years old, you know, I was in my 20s, I'd had a regular job, I knew the records that I loved, and I was just like, this, in my brain, I was like, it's not going to sound good this way, and so it's not going to work, and then I've just got something out there that I don't even like, that people are going to think I liked because my name's on it, and they're going to think that this is what I intended, and so... you know, and making the second record, you know, on an indie was great too. They had incredible, you know, they had good ideas actually compared to Polydor. They would say, okay, well, how about horns in Princess Leia? And I was just like, that's such a brilliant idea. I'd never thought to use horns. How exciting, how thrilling. And, you know, they have secretly have a band with a horn player. So I was like, can I borrow you? You know, and that was fantastic. Mm. But in the end, I think, you know, all of them don't really necessarily know what they're doing, and you know, it's, if things work, I never really think it's because of the label, and you know, that's just how, of course, I think that if something's working, a label can then kind of do something to make that better, or to kind of amplify that, I guess, to use terms that they might use, but I think in the end, you know, I think they're all making it up as they go along, as we all are to an extent. And I think in the end, you just have to do stuff that you have to say yes to the things that you know you're going to be okay with and you're happy with. And that's really all that you can do. I think if you start saying yes to things you're not sure about, then you get into really tricky territory long term for your for your mental
absolutely.
Health.
Absolutely. I think that you've kind of hit the nail on the head there, really. I was thinking when you were saying about, you know, I just said no because no one really knows. And that's the thing I've learned as I've got older is the only way that you can kind of survive is by being true to yourself. And so even if you put something out and nothing happens with it, but you love it, you know in your heart that you did your best for something that you love and you haven't kind of compromised. And I think that's one way that you can kind of keep the keep your sense of self and and purpose, I guess, as an artist. It's just really it's fantastic to hear you talking about about this subject, really.
My manager and I we constantly kind of go back to the idea of the power of no, and that's not the power to of no and to feel, you know, I'm not doing that because I'm better than you. It's not about that at all. It's about there's strength in no, and sometimes no is the right answer, and it's something that I sort of hold dear to myself. It's you know, absolutely not about being open, you know, to collaboration and working with others. It's just, you know, it's okay to say no.
It 100% is. Shura, well, tell us now, what is next for you? It would be nice to hear about what's in the plans and what is exciting you the most.
I found it really difficult to write the last year. I don't know if that's something that you both feel. I'm a very much a no input, no output kind of a person. And I found that being, you know, I lived in New York for 3 years, and I was in New York for the very start of the pandemic with my partner. And that was a very, very strange experience. I kind of landed there the day that they had banned gatherings over 5 people. And, you know, moments later, they were sort of discussing burying bodies in Central Park as a temporary measure because there was just, the hospitals were overrun. So and as an anxious person too, I find that stress is really not conducive for me to create. But in the last kind of, I guess in the last, because it's been going on for 18 months now, I guess in the last kind of year, I've begun, you know, the process of writing. But I will say that it's hard. And I think I have this at the end of every record I've ever made. I'm like, I'm never doing that again.
There's I've got nothing to write moment. About.
I can't possibly do that again. Yeah, yeah, I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I've written everything I could write. And then suddenly, you know, you'll just be home alone. That's the way it is with me. You know, my partner will be in New York still and I'll be home and I'll just pick up a guitar and I'll just start quietly noodling. And I'm like, oh, no. Something's there. Mm-hmm. And so I've begun writing for who knows what it is, you know, whether it's
how exciting
a record or an EP, but it's nice to get back into it. It has been really, this one's been difficult though. Mm-hmm. It's been much harder than beginning the process of writing for the second one. And I think it's just a lot of it's down to kind of just these extraordinary circumstances and also having a, you know, an album campaign cut short, you know, you have, I'm almost not ready to be like forever's done because it doesn't feel done to me. And of course it isn't done, you know, it still exists. I'll still tour it and songs from it, but it's a strange sort of goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I completely feel you on that. I had a similar experience with my record came out right in the middle of the pandemic, and it's that in it, you know, when you can't tour it and you can't sort of play it live, it's a strange feeling, isn't it? And then trying to work out how to move on from it or whether to stick with it. I definitely had a little while of kind of finding myself and where to go, but I think like everything, time is a wonderful thing, and I'm sure that there's going to be some incredible sounds coming from your studio very soon. I'm so excited to hear them.
Yeah, we're so excited to hear it, Shura.
Me too.
Thank you so much for joining us and gifting us with this beautiful conversation. And thank you.
It's been such a joy. Thanks, Shura.
It's really lovely, you know, to talk about stuff and, you know, about those details as well, because I think, you know, we all love them. It's partly why we do what we do the way we do it. So it's really nice to like have these types of conversations.
You've been listening to The Detail. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Katie Melua.
And I'm Polly Scattergood.
And we've had the incredible Shura on our show today.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, it's been lovingly made by me and Katie. The editing, however, has been done by me in my studio. So if you're a fan of this podcast and you'd like to hear more, receive additional content and the odd special treat sent directly from me to you, please head on over to my Patreon page to give your support. The address is patreon.com/PollyScattergood. Thanks so much.